Hi, this is Dan Kilbride. I am the host of New Books in American Studies. I also teach early American history at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Today, we are joined by Randy Sparks, who is a professor of history at Tulane University, where I assume, unlike here, it is not snowing. And we're going to talk to him today about his new book, Where the Negroes Are Masters, An African Port in the Era of the Slave Trade, which has just been published by Harvard University Press. Professor Sparks is also the author of The Two Princes of Calabar, an 18th century Atlantic odyssey, which I have used in class before, and I'm using in class again next semester. So I strongly recommend that book to you. So Randy Sparks, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thanks, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and especially what brought you to this book?
Well, as you've already said, I'm a professor of history at Tulane University, where I've been for about 10 years or so now. I am a Southern historian and a historian of the African Atlantic world. And as you've kindly mentioned, my previous book is called The Two Princes of Calabar, an 18th Century Atlantic Odyssey, which focused on the story of two African slave traders, members of a prominent slave trading family in Old Calabar, who were captured, kidnapped into slavery, and enslaved in the Americas, and through a very roundabout way managed to reach England and through the courts gained their freedom and returned home again to Old Calabar. And that, in many ways, that project led me to this one, Dan, because I thought when I wrote that book that their case must be, you know, very exceptional, that there couldn't be many other examples of Africans who were kidnapped into the trade and then found their way home again. But I ran across other examples, and I began to try to research other similar cases and to track them down. And one of those cases was a man named William Sesoroko, who was from the Gold Coast, from a slave trading town called Anamabo. And I was able to track him back to the Gold Coast. And it was that research that led me to this town of Anamabo. And once I began to do that research, I realized that there was a much bigger story here than the simple, well, I say simple, the relatively simple story of William Sesoroko, which was the story I set out to tell, but I was led to a much bigger story.
Right. Since this is a podcast on American studies, maybe we should lay a foundation here so our listeners can understand things. You already mentioned this area of history, a relatively new one, that you called the, you know, Atlantic world or Atlantic studies. I wondered if you could, I know this is going to be a tough request, but in sort of 50 words or less, could you just describe what we mean when we talk about the Atlantic world?
The Atlantic world is a sort of a new lens, I suppose, for viewing the history of the coming together of the continents of Europe and Africa and North and South America in the wake of Columbus's discovery, in quotation marks, of America. So it looks at the movement of goods, people, and ideas around the Atlantic world and how those four continents came into conversation with one another, how the Atlantic was suddenly transformed from a barrier into a bridge.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you said, the town of Anamabo is located on what historians call the Gold Coast of Africa. What can you tell us about just what's important to know about the background of the Gold Coast, and especially of this town, which, as you say in your book, is at least in the period when it was flourishing and the slave trade was sort of similar in size and significance to like Charleston, South Carolina, and Newport, Rhode Island.
That's right. The Gold Coast is located on the west coast of Africa, and it became a major slave trading hub around 1700 or so, and continued to be a major exporter of slaves all the way down to the end of that legal slave trade in 1808 or 07. So it was one of the major centers for the export of slaves to the Americas, and Anamobo was the most important town on the Gold Coast and the most important place for the export of those slaves to the Americas.
Mm-hmm. Say the name of the town for me again, because I'm getting it wrong.
Anamobo.
Anamobo. Okay. How did this town, why did this town become so significant as a port on the Gold Coast?
Well, in many ways it didn't have a lot of natural, advantages. There is no, what we think of as a port at Anamobo. You can't sail up to a harbor at Anamobo. Mm-hmm. British ships European ships had to anchor about a mile off the coast of Anamobo. So it's not exactly a natural port. It rose to some importance earlier in the 17th century when it was an exporter of gold, hence the name, right? Gold Coast, right. Which the Portuguese first gave to that coast. And then it became a convenient stopover for slave ships from other parts of the west coast of Africa as a supplier of foodstuffs to those slave ships, particularly maize, which was brought from the Americas and became a staple of the diet there and was widely cultivated and was a major export from the port before. Well, it continued to be all through the period, but the trade in gold and maize and other supplies for the slave ships was what first brought it to prominence.
Right. What I think that I think there's so much in this book and in similar books about the Atlantic world, one of which I just used a book called The Diligent, yes. Which on about a French slave trading ship. I think micro histories like this and like The Diligent really help bring this enormous thing that we call the Atlantic slave trade, which, again, as you mentioned, is the largest forced migration in human history, involving anywhere between 10 and 12 million people. Yes. It's almost like the Holocaust in its sheer scale. It's hard to humanize. It's hard to bring it down to a comprehensible scale. And I think that books like this and Robert Harms's The Diligent really do that. And it's sort of a microcosm of a much larger thing that's going on. And
Also, Dan, for so long the history of the slave trade was dominated by what historians refer to as the numbers game. You know, trying to arrive at some reasonable estimate for the size of that
that's
trade.
Right.
So for a very long time that dominated the history, and it was very heavily statistical. It didn't have much of a human dimension. And mm-hmm. So that's exactly, I think, what people like Robert Harms in The Diligent, and it's certainly what I tried to do in this book. I mean, I think of this book as a biography of an African town. And
right.
I did try even in this book to humanize that story by focusing as much as I could on individuals and you know, to put real people in that history.
Right. I mean, it's when I teach courses on slavery and African American history, I like to use the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, which is this wonderful online resource. But of course, the problem there is that we go right back to the numbers game.
That's
and
right.
It's very hard to find the human beings in those numbers.
Right. And
it's a real challenge.
The other important thing I think for students to understand too is that the slave trade was conducted very differently in different parts of Africa. You know, mm-hmm. there's not just one slave trade. In fact, there are many slave trades, right? And it's important for us to understand how that trade differed, say, in Anamobo than it did in Old Calabar, which was the site of my previous book. So
right.
That's an important thing, I think, also for students to understand.
Yeah. One thing I think that comes through loud and clear, especially in your first chapter, that some people would find very surprising is who called the shots on the Gold Coast. And I have another pronunciation question. What's the pronunciation?
Yes, the Fanti.
The Fanti. There's some, I hesitate to use the word funny, but I did find them funny. Some funny stories in the first chapter about the frustrations of the English authorities, especially of the Royal African Company, as they tried to deal with the local African authorities. And just having no success at all. You know, as you say, the Fanti were – they call the shots. And in almost every power struggle between the English and local Africans, it was the local Africans who ended up winning.
Absolutely.
How is – again, I think that most people who look at the slave trade who are not specialists, and that's most people who are listening to this podcast – are going to say, wait a minute, you know, the Africans are the victims here. They're being enslaved. How is it that the Africans are calling the shots in this exchange? How is that possible?
Well, I think if we pause for a minute and think about the way that slave trade was conducted, the Fanti are essentially the middlemen. They control the trade along the coast. Most of the supply of slaves, probably three quarters, is coming from deeper in the interior, particularly from the Asante Empire, which was expanding very rapidly over the course of most of this 18th century and kept a steady stream of slaves pouring toward the Gold Coast. But the Fanti were able to position themselves as middlemen between the Asante in the interior and the Europeans who arrived on the coast. And even though the Europeans built, you know, these very impressive-looking forts, which are still impressive-looking today, and Anambo Fort still stands, in fact, today, and they do look very imposing, but in fact, it's really a mistake to think of them as forts so much as they were armed trading posts. Mm-hmm. And the number of Europeans in those forts at any given time would have been very small. They were simply overwhelmed by the local population, and they depended entirely on the local population, for example, for their food and sustenance. I mean, the guns were normally pointed in those forts not toward the Africans in the towns in which they resided, but outward to the sea. Mm-hmm. Really meant to defend the Europeans from other Europeans more than they were from the Africans. They resided in those Africans according to treaties that they negotiated with local rulers. They paid ground rent for the right to occupy those forts, and that could be withdrawn and sometimes was. Mm-hmm. So the Europeans really were fairly weak players in this period. It's a mistake to confuse what was happening in this period with what happens in the colonial era in the 19th century, where
right.
It's a very different story in this period.
Yep. And, of course, for most Europeans, a trip to Africa was a little bit short of a death sentence. You throw some statistics out in your first chapter about crews of Europeans who arrive perfectly healthy in Africa, and then something like a month or two later, they're all laid up.
Yeah.
They can barely function.
Yeah, and the death rate in some cases was astronomically high. And it's sort of the reverse of what happens in the Americas, where Native Americans die, in huge numbers from diseases introduced by Europeans to which they had no natural immunity. It's sort of the same for the Europeans who arrive in Africa and confront a disease climate, mm-hmm. which they have no immunity and which was deadly to them.
Right. Of course, Europeans also, those who survived, those who were lucky enough to survive, also established, many of them established relationships with the local African population, which, of course, vastly outnumbered the European population. And, I mentioned a minute ago how the local Africans drove the English authorities absolutely crazy with their demands for rum and for tribute and various things. But sometimes the English soldiers and the officials also drove the European officials kind of crazy. There was one guy, I can't remember his name, but who was seems to have been constantly kind of shifted between Cape Coast Castle and an Amiibo fort because the local authorities just didn't know what to do with him.
Well, that's and, right. I mean, he had established very close, friendships and trade relationships with the Africans in the town. I mean, again, the Europeans were very much dependent on those Africans in the town. And often they did enter into, various kinds of business and personal relationships with the Africans. And yes, sometimes it was a little hard for the English authorities to tell where their loyalties actually lay because, they needed the support of the Africans in the town. And then, of course, there's the whole business of country marriages where they enter into long-term relationships with Fanti women that are also a very important part of life in the town and the relationships mm-hmm. that govern the relationships between the Europeans and the English and the Africans.
Yeah, I remember one of the English chiefs of the fort at one point writes back home and saying, "This guy is giving away all our trade secrets. You know, he's telling the Africans, yes. you know, all our stuff. Yes. You know, whose side is this guy on?"
Exactly.
But in Africa, it was the Africans who called the shots.
That's right.
One person who is very prominent in this book is a guy named is it John Coranti?
Coranti, yes.
Coranti, right? And this guy was sort of almost a Kissingerian diplomat. I mean, he was very good at manipulating,
very crafty politician.
The English, not just English, but playing off the English and the French and other Europeans. This is, the British are the most important European power in this book, but of course, the slave trade is an open competition between various European powers who are establishing plantations in the New World and looking for workers. How was he able to manipulate Europeans to establish his own power base?
Well, he's a fascinating character, and as I said, I started this project by following William Sesoroco back to Anamabo and thinking that he would be my story, but it was through him that I met his father, who was John Coranti, who really is the most important figure in Anamabo and the most important figure in the entire Gold Coast during this period. I was also able to piece together pretty much not a full-fledged biography of him, but a much fuller biography of him than anyone had done before. His story, I think it isn't entirely clear, but he was certainly related to the most powerful Cabocier, which is the title that was given to sort of the local rulers among the Fanti states and towns. And he mentions that he was taken into the English fort at Cape Coast Castle as a youth and educated there, and even in his old age could still recite the alphabet and that sort of thing. So he learned English as very young, also though it's clear kept his eyes open when he was in as a youth in Cape Coast Castle, and he learned very, very much about the English ways, and he was able to turn all of that knowledge to his advantage. He was just a masterful politician, and so he really plays a big role, I think, in leading Anamabo to its position of prominence in this period. So he was, not only was he a political leader, a diplomat, as you say, he also, of course, was responsible for governing the town locally, mm-hmm. Also, carrying out diplomatic relations with the African states surrounding him. And he was also a very prominent military leader and regarded as a fierce warrior. He's a very well-rounded figure, and I think deserves a prominent place in the history of the 18th century Atlantic world. He really is a masterful politician, and he understands how these European states are vying with one another, not only in Africa but in Europe. And in that regard, he sends one son to France to the French court, And he sent another son, William Sacerocco, to London. And that son was kidnapped en route to London, but did eventually arrive there. And so he uses these sons as his eyes and ears in London and Paris. And through all those means, just becomes incredibly knowledgeable, not only about how to affect political change in Africa, but how to play those European major powers off against one another. And the way he plays the French and the English off one another is really very impressive.
I think. And he is I think that people would find him to be almost a morally puzzling figure, because he does, as you mentioned, he does really complicate the conventional moral calculus of the slave trade that portrays, understandably, Africans as victims and Europeans as victimizers, because that doesn't fit this guy at all.
He's
an essential middleman in between, because, one of the things that, again, that's important to understand is that very few of the slaves who are going on the boats are coming from the immediate area of the town. They're coming from far inland, in some cases, very far inland, and being brought to the coast. Yet here's a guy who, as you said, he has to rescue one son from slavery, yet he is also responsible for enslaving, what, tens of thousands?
Undoubtedly.
Other people.
He is not only the political leader who is largely responsible, I think, for positioning Anambo as the major slave trading port on the Gold Coast, but he himself is directly involved in the slave trade. I mean, he made his fortune through the slave trade. So he was also a prominent trader, merchant, along with all these other hats he wore. So, yes, he was directly responsible for the enslavement of probably tens of thousands of other Africans. And, there were even some allegations that he may have been responsible for kidnapping some of those people himself. So, yes, he's a very complicated figure. And as you suggest, the question of the morality of the slave trade becomes very murky the closer you get to it on the ground.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to answer a question that I always get when I teach this class, and it's apropos to this conversation we've been having. How could a man who had to rescue one of his own sons from slavery in the New World be responsible for the slavery of thousands or tens of thousands of others? How could simply Africans enslave other Africans?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to remember that, the concept of Africa really is a European construct. I mean, Africans did not think of the place they lived as Africa. They did not think of themselves as Africans. They thought of themselves as members of certain ethnic groups, in this case, the Fanti, they faced a lot of enemies, and it was largely from that group that they derived their slaves. I mean, the other major source of slaves on the Gold Coast, probably about a fourth of them, did come from within the Fanti Confederacy, and those largely were people who were convicted of crimes and would have otherwise been put to death. So, the major source of slaves are people who are regarded as criminals who would have been executed, whose lives are therefore forfeit, right? And who can be sold and, sold away because their lives have been forfeit. And the other would have been prisoners of war, who are in the same condition, whose lives have been forfeit and could be, executed, and certainly tens of thousands of them were executed rather than sold. So, it's a complicated moral equation, and one that we might not necessarily embrace, but this was the understanding, I think, and money is a powerful lure.
Right. I don't want to get too esoteric and historiographical, because nothing is more certain to put people to sleep than historiography, but including myself. But you know, it has been – there's a kind of an argument among historians about the extent to which Europeans were able to pressure Africans – to sell them slaves. And some historians have posited what they've called a guns to slaves cycle,
right.
Sort of arguing in essence that Europeans got Africans addicted to guns, which of course they controlled the access to the firearms and the gunpowder and the ammunition, and that, you know, injecting these guns into African societies set off a spiral of warfare, leading to slaves, the slaves then being sold to the Europeans for more guns and ammunition and so forth. One historian in particular named John Thornton, who I know you're familiar with, has been extremely critical of this this argument because he says it kind of takes the agency away from Africans like Clarence and it sort of infantilizes them. I wonder what you think about arguments about things like the gun slave cycle and the extent to which Africans really were in charge of things on the ground, including the supply of slaves.
Well, I've learned a lot from John Thornton over the years, and he's a great inspiration for a lot of the work I do on the Black Atlantic. And I do agree with his assessment of that important argument. I mean, it is, and I think I've tried to make this point in the book. I don't think that the trade in guns and ammunition in Africa, which is a hugely important part of the trade, is entirely unrelated to warfare in Africa. In fact, I think, for example, that the Fanti benefited enormously from their access to weapons, which was much greater. Given their role as middlemen, their access to European guns and ammunition was much greater than was the case of groups more further in the interior. And mm-hmm. I think particularly in their wars of expansion, that was great benefit to them. But I think it would be a mistake to imagine that the Fanti wars or the Asante wars were fueled by that trade. I think those wars would have gone on with or without the trade. But certainly they played a role in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If that clarifies anything.
Yeah, I think it does. You said it better than I could. As we've said before, Africans drove Europeans crazy with their demands for goods and the high prices for slaves. Yet Europeans controlled access to firearms. Why do you think that Europeans didn't have, therefore, more leverage, given they controlled access to guns and ammunition? And these were things that the Fanti in particular were increasingly dependent upon.
Well, I mean, the slave trade is a market, right? I mean, it was driven largely by the laws of supply and demand. Those might not have been fully understood at the time. I mean, certainly you see, you know, the trade in slaves spike when the Asante are engaged in a major expedition or something. I mean, you do see these ebbs and flows in the trade that we can often tie very directly to the wars that are underway at any given moment. So, you know, there is, and you do, of course, see a rising demand for guns and weapons and ammunition at the same time, right? I mean, so again, they sort of go hand in hand in a way, in that, you know, the wars increase demand for guns and ammunition and at the same time produce more slaves, right? So,
yep.
So, yeah, it's in some ways, a very symbiotic sort of relationship.
Right. In your chapter on a guy named Richard Brew.
Yes.
We've been talking about guns, but of course there were many, many other commodities that Europeans needed to hold on their ships in order to meet what for them was a maddeningly fickle and complex African demand. And, you know, one thing I like about this book and also about the book, The Diligent, is, most people seem to think that European ships just kind of pulled up to an African port, like you would drive into a supermarket, and just loaded their slaves on the ship and then pulled away. Whereas very often it took, you know, several months to fill a slave ship, and you never really knew what commodities the Africans who controlled the trade were going to want in exchange for their slaves. You could have a ship full of textiles, and then the Africans would say, wait, we need guns, or we need lead bars and things like that. So in this chapter on Richard Brew, you talk about some of the commodities that Africans demanded for slaves. What were the major commodities that they wanted, and where did they come from?
Well, along with the guns and ammunition, which would of course been manufactured in Britain, another probably the other largest group of trade goods would have been fabrics. Those came from various sources, and they were in very high demand. But as you suggest, the trade could be problematic because often, you know, Africans were very insistent on a particular pattern, a particular color. I mean, you might send out a load of fabrics that would have sold very well, you know, the year before, but might not be worth very much by the time they arrived on the coast. Those fabrics came from some of them from England, of course. I mean, this is also the period of the Industrial Revolution, driven in large part by the manufacture of cloth, right? So that's one major source. But also another major source was India. So it's not just an Atlantic story. The tentacles of the trade reach much further than just the Atlantic. So right. India provided also a substantial amount of that fabric. And then, of course, you mentioned also the trade in iron, those iron bars. I mean, those were tons and tons and tons of these iron mm-hmm. bars were traded and then melted down by local smiths and manufactured into other kinds of goods. There was also a substantial trade in cooking utensils made out of brass or copper, knives, which were used I think primarily for agriculture and that sort of thing, but knives were traded mm-hmm. in the millions. And also a trade in luxury goods, which might even include some unsuspected things like, you know, English furniture and clothes and silks and brocades and satins and swords and, feathered hats and all that sort of thing, mirrors, things like that that might not immediately pop to mind.
Right. You mentioned towards the end of that chapter that Richard Brew's had that sort of Georgian mansion. You mentioned this kind of incongruity that you see in Africa. He's got a Georgian mansion in the town, and you call it sort of a microcosm of the African Atlantic world. What did you mean by that?
Well, Richard Brew is another fascinating character, you know, a native of Ireland who comes out to the coast and is probably, I think, in his early 20s and in a short time rises up to be the chief of one of the smaller outforts and obviously is a man also of great skill and ability and then becomes eventually the chief of the fort at Anamabo, where he sort of comes into contact with John Carranti, and the two of them have a wonderfully complicated relationship because Brew took as his country wife John Carranti's daughter, and then had a mixed race family. He spent his entire life with her in what he called Castle Brew, this you know, Georgian a mansion furnished with, you know, the highest luxury goods, you know, mahogany furniture and crystal goblets and you know, every luxury that money could afford, you know, was on display in Castle Brew. So Castle Brew was home to not only to Brew himself, but to his African country wife and their mixed race children. It also housed, it had storehouses to house the vast quantities of European trade goods that Brew imported. I think he also may have housed some slaves there. The fort also was open to the traders to house their slaves. So probably he would have had more of them housed there, but there might well have been some of them at Castle Brew. And of course he had his own African slaves, his personal slaves who lived and worked at Castle Brew. So yeah, I mean it is an amazingly incongruous sort of building, and it too still stands remarkably.
Really? Yes. Wow. Another thing that's incongruous is a statement that he makes, and you quote at the very end of your chapter where he says, "I'm a friend to liberty. And I mortally hate logs and chains, though I live in the midst of slaves and slavery." Yes. How could he be a friend to liberty yet be an extremely successful slave merchant?
Well, I mean, isn't that the $64,000 question? And when we ask about our own founding fathers who were slaveholders, right? I mean,
indeed,
you wonder that their heads didn't explode, but. So Brew was not alone, of course, in calling himself a lover of liberty and valuing his own personal liberty very highly, but then perfectly willing to trample on the rights of others. It's a wonderful quote. The reference to logs and chains is a reference to the way that slaves were brought from the interior of Africa into the town of Anambo, and often, rather than being, imprisoned or something, they were allowed to be outside, but they were kept captive by a chain, to their ankle, which was then attached to a log. So, the reference is a very direct one to what Brew would have seen every time he walked around the right. town of Anambo.
Yeah. We already talked about the kind of debate about the sort of guns and slave cycle. In your chapter on the process of enslavement, you discussed this, the fancy kind of blaming Europeans for the slave trade, right. That the Europeans had sort of created this demand for slavery, and then they had come to Africa with their guns and their liquor and all these wonderful things. Why did the Fanti think it was necessary to try to shift blame on the Europeans for this?
It is a great turn on their part, isn't it? To cast Europeans and as the role of the enslavers, and of course they're not entirely wrong, are they? I mean, the Europeans did create the demand, and they were of course responsible for shipping those millions of Africans across the Atlantic. So the Fanti certainly weren't entirely wrong. Some of this came from this sometimes conflicted relationship between the Fanti and the British, who were often very critical of the Fanti in various ways. So yeah, the Fanti find a way to sort of to cast the blame back on the British.
Right. Another remarkable exchange that you describe in this chapter is a speech of a captain named William Snelgrave, who appears a lot in the literature on slavery and the slave trade. He confronted a slave rebellion on his ship, and he told his captives something very interesting. I wondered how they received it, but what can you tell our listeners? What did Snelgrave tell his slaves?
Well, I mean, Snelgrave essentially said, have you been badly treated on board this ship? Right? Have you been abused? Haven't you been well treated? And Snelgrave, does sort of takes the opposite approach to the Fanti's description of the trade that we just talked about. I mean, Snelgrave points out that you know, he wasn't the enslaver, right? They were already enslaved, that they'd been legally purchased. And you know, had it not been for that, they would probably be dead. So, yeah, it's sort of the flip side of the Fantese argument.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminded me a little bit of a speech. Those people who have watched the film 12 Years a Slave might be familiar with this, but there's a scene in which a character named Bass, who was played by Brad Pitt in the film, is talking to the character played by Michael Fassbender, who's the Epps, the bad slave owner. And he's trying to argue, you know, how can you, you know, own these people? How these? And he says, "Well, I bought them. I can show you the receipt, you know." And it's sort of Snelgrave's argument too, like, just, you know, behave yourselves. Yep. I bought you fair and square.
Fair and square, yes. That's Snelgrave's argument, and you know that he was not the enslaver, right? It was their own countrymen who'd done the enslaving. Was his argument to the Africans. Now you're right. We don't know how they received it. It probably didn't find it terribly convincing, but
probably not.
but it is an interesting argument nonetheless, and is an insight, I think, into the minds of the captains of those ships. And, you know, I mean, we must, you know, you have to wonder how they could have rationalized such horror as the Middle Passage and all the suffering that was a part of it. But so I think Snelgrave's little speech does offer some insight into how their minds worked. And how they were able to justify, you know, that horror to themselves.
Yeah, it is hard. And you know, one of the things I think we all try to do as historians is to urge our readers and our students to empathize. But it is hard to empathize with slave ship captains. And, you know, there's some, you know, accounts of the means that captains and crews employed to ensure discipline on their ships, which are absolutely horrifying. And, you know, it makes it hard to put yourself into their shoes. No, for sure.
It really does. It's very difficult for us. But I think you're right. It's necessary in a way, right? I mean, we have to try to understand, even though that doesn't mean we have to sympathize. You know, it's important to try to understand.
That's right.
They were about.
This book does, we've been talking about the British and the Africans especially, but this book does eventually get to the United States, and in particular a group of people who you call the Rum Men.
Yes.
Who are the Rum Men, and what do they have to do with trading an Anamabo?
Well, the Rum Men are Rhode Islanders, and Rhode Island was a major shipping colony under the British colonial system, and they, once the slave trade is opened up to all comers, these Rhode Islanders become engaged in the slave trade. They are an important link in that triangular trade, right? So they bring alcohol, or actually they're bringing, you know, one of the byproducts of sugar production. They bring that to Rhode Island, where they build refineries and manufacture the rum. They're not, for the most part, buying the rum in the Caribbean. They're manufacturing the rum in Rhode Island. So that distilling becomes an important industry. And then they take that rum to the west coast of Africa, where it becomes the most popular alcoholic beverage on the west coast of Africa, supplants what had been, you know, brandy had been sort of the alcohol of choice before rum arrived on the scene. But rum becomes much more popular, and the Rhode Islanders actually distill a higher octane rum that was extremely popular on the west coast of Africa. And then they trade that rum for slaves, and they carry those slaves largely to the Caribbean and to the southern colonies of South Carolina and Virginia, though some, of course, do also wind up in Rhode Island, which was also a slaveholding colony. Well, all the colonies were in this period slaveholding colonies.
You know, in this chapter, you kind of bring us on the ships, and it's really interesting to put yourself in the shoes of one of the owners or the investors of one of these vessels. As you talk, the slave trade was very risky.
Very risky.
Right. I mean, every business venture is risky, but thinking about these guys are investing in ships, which they're not going to see for at least another year.
Right.
By the time they go to Africa, do their trading, come back, if they ever see them. And it's not like you can just get your GPS and see where the ship is.
No.
Besides the dangers that these ships faced from their enslaved cargoes, the fate of the threat of rebellion and disease and et cetera, they also faced problem with their crew. What were the crew members of these ships like?
Well, yes. I mean, the crews, as you say, the slave trade was a risky business. It took people away from their homes for a very long time. It was, as you've also suggested, in many ways, an unpleasant business. And so it sometimes attracted some rough characters. Mm-hmm. And yes, they could take over a ship. They could turn pirates. They could be very difficult to control. Absolutely. As you suggest, once that ship sails off into the Atlantic, then that ship becomes its own little microcosm in a very complicated interplay of people on board those ships.
Another thing you mentioned in that chapter is the desire of slave owners, or rather ship owners, to attract or purchase, I should say, certain ethnic groups.
Yes.
In Africa.
Right.
And sometimes the extent that they were successful at doing that could result in the sort of a concentration of a certain group of slaves in a particular area. To what extent do you think that ship owners and captains sort of understood ethnic divisions in Africa? And to what extent did the African slave trade distribute slaves sort of randomly throughout the Atlantic? And to what extent could they be concentrated in particular places?
Well, Dan, that, as you know, is a very complicated question.
Yeah. Sorry about that. But
still busy debating, right? So without going too far into the historiography, I would say that captains certainly had some understanding of ethnic divisions among the Africans that they purchased, as did the slave owners in the Americas, who had demands for slaves from particular ethnic groups who they thought had qualities of one kind or another that made them more valuable in a particular time and place. I think probably captains understood less than they thought they did. You also see the slave traders, the European slave traders and the African slave traders, for that matter, on the coast of Africa, manipulating these categories themselves. I mean, you had governors of the forts, for example, the British forts, who would bring slaves from other parts of Africa who sold more cheaply because slaves from the Gold Coast were in high demand and were valued more highly. But the governors would sometimes, and the chiefs of the outforts would sometimes bring in slaves from other parts of Africa that were less valuable and sell them as if they were Gold Coast slaves. And this was not always easy to do with more experienced captains, but could certainly be done with less experienced captains. So, mm-hmm. I think again that the Europeans probably understood less than they thought they did. You do get, because of the nature of the trade, because of its rise and fall, you do get, large exports from, say, the Gold Coast that peak at certain times. And you also – so you would see concentrations of slaves from the Gold Coast arriving in places like Charleston and Kingston, Jamaica, at particular moments in time. And so you do have certainly concentrations of slaves from the Gold Coast in, places in the Americas. Now, but that's complicated too, right? Because this also depends on where from where in the interior those slaves are being brought. They're not all coming from a single ethnic group at any
time. Sure.
And some of this depends on those Asante wars of expansion. So, you know, at one moment the Asante are engaged in a war with one ethnic group, and at 10 years later it's a different ethnic group, and so or more than one at any given moment, and so you know the ethnicity is a very complicated question,
and
very very difficult to disentangle. Though it is certainly very important too for slave culture in the Americas, particularly in the period of the slave trade.
Yep. We've been talking about sort of the rise of Anambobo, but at a certain point, the town went into decline. And of course, the single most important blow to the slave trade there was the abolition of the slave trade by Britain in January of 1808. But it wasn't the only factor that went into the decline of the town. Can you talk about how, as you say, things fell apart in Anambobo?
Yes, along with the abolition of the trade, which of course, you know, devastated the economy. Right? I mean that, you know, the economy of the town had been built on that trade, and without it, the economy just simply collapsed. But the other major factor here is a war with the Asante, and this is where, that long history of diplomacy. For example, John Caranti, you see John Caranti, who's able to form alliances with other states to prevent the Asante from reaching the coast. I mean, this was sort of the overriding goal of the Fante, was to maintain their position as middlemen and not to allow the Fante to take charge of the coast themselves, which would have
Right.
kept them out of the trade. And so For a century or so, they're actually very successful at that, though they were far weaker than the Asante. I mean, the Asante Empire was vast compared to the Fante Confederacy, and it was a much more powerful empire. But it is largely through the failure of diplomacy that they wind up in this conflict with the Asante. And in that war, they were just completely devastated. I mean, the Asante, within a very short time, reached Anambobo, attacked the fort. The Asante were just slaughtered and died by the tens of thousands. I mean, it was just carnage. So these two things together, the abolition of the slave trade, which destroyed the economy, combined with this devastating war with the Asante, just destroyed the town. And had the slave trade continued, the town might have recovered. But with its economic base gone, it could not. And so, you know, now it is a fairly sleepy village, very small town today.
Right. I think you mentioned that I know this sounds incongruous given that it's a slave fort, but it kind of has a guest book
Yes.
that you can sign. And so Yes. does Cape Coast Castle, which is Yes. sort of right down the coast, and which is a far more popular destination, I take it.
That's right. I mean, Cape Coast Castle, you know, almost now when any Western leader like President Obama visits Ghana, it's Cape Coast Castle, right? It's the door of no return. I mean, that has become the sort of principal site of memory, certainly on the Gold Coast and arguably on the entire West Coast of Africa for the history of the slave trade. But in fact, far more slaves left from Anambobo than left from Cape Coast Castle. And Anambobo's fort, as I said, still stands today. For many years, it was a prison. But just in the last couple of years, the town has tried to turn it into a museum. So far without very much success, but in terms of, you know, a site of memory for the history of the slave trade, it's incredibly important. And the town itself, along with the fort, you have Richard Brew's Castle Brew still stands, though I think the history of it maybe virtually lost. I don't think it is celebrated as Castle Brew. I'm not sure that history shows up now, but the building is still there. And so is John Caranti's palace, which was built by the Dutch as a trading building in the 17th century. The buildings of, isn't it amazing that all of the,
it is amazing.
All of those buildings are still standing there today. It should be an important site of memory for the history of the slave trade.
And I also observed that when the British abolished the slave trade, many of their African former partners were just incredulous.
Completely.
Like, you know, how could you do this? You know, we're doing business together. You know, it's kind of, again, I think people would find that, I guess ironic isn't the right word, but just kind of very surprising.
Right. No, I mean, the Africans could hardly believe what was happening to them and could scarcely wrap their minds around the fact that one day, you know, the slave trade is legal and booming and going along at its usual clip, and the next day, it's over. It was, as you can imagine, very hard for the Africans to understand. But of course, it would be a mistake to think that the slave trade ended either. Of course, it didn't.
That's right. Yeah,
it moved though. Partly the fact that the Gold Coast was so exposed, and the fact that there were these British forts scattered all along the Gold Coast, meant that the British were able to largely shut down the trade from the Gold Coast. And so the trade shifted further to the north and further to the south. And there, while there was a dip in the trade immediately following abolition in 1808, that trade revived, and pretty soon the volume of that trade was virtually as large in the 19th century as it was in the 18th, which is actually what I'm researching right now.
Well, there you go. That's my next question, because we've kept you for the better part of an hour, so we're going to let you go. But before we do, why don't you tell us what your next step is?
Well, I have completed a manuscript that's been accepted by Harvard Press. So, and that is another sort of micro history of Africans in the Old South. It tells the story about there. I think six chapters will be devoted to individuals or groups of individual Africans in the Old South, going from about 1740 through the antebellum period. And it's microhistory. So, you know, one of the characteristics of microhistory is that, you know, you don't look for the typical, you look for the outliers. You look for the stories that challenge the sort of macro history, the sort of accepted narrative. So, for example, the first chapter is the story of a mixed race woman from one of these prominent slave trading families in what is today Sierra Leone, who moved to Charleston, South Carolina in 1740, bought plantations and lived her life as a member of the South Carolina planter elite. Not the story one would normally expect.
No.
so that's just one example of the kind of Africans I've identified and whose stories I'll be telling in my next book. And my larger project is a study of the U.S. involvement in the illegal slave trade of the 19th century.
Oh, fabulous. Well, Randy Sparks, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
So we've been speaking with Randy Sparks. He is the author of Where the Negroes Are Masters, An African Port in the Era of the Slave Trade. And as you look on this page on New Books in American Studies, you will see an icon of this book, which will lead you to its Amazon.com page. So, historians write books to make piles and piles of money. So,
yes, that's exactly why we write books.
Exactly why. So buy this book. So thank you, everybody. This is, once again, Dan Kilbride, the host of New Books in American Studies, and we will see you again. So long.